This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. We will talk about the top stories in international, national, and state politics on this edition of The Week in Review with two guests from different perspectives, and we will invite your input, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's welcome our guests. We have in studio with us Kevin Benversi, the Research Director with Media Trackers. Good morning.
Morning.
And also Matt Rothschild, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Good morning.
Hey, Joy. It's nice to see you again.
It's good to have you both here. Let's talk about the G20 summit, which kicks off today. President Trump will have his highly anticipated face-to-face meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The two are set to meet later this hour. So before the hour is up, that meeting will have started. This will be the first in-person meeting between the two leaders and the first official bilateral meeting between a U.S. and Russian president in nearly 2 years. So let's start with you, Matt. What do you expect when these two sit down together?
Well, I'd love to be a fly on the wall, as I'm sure you would, and our listeners would, too. I think Trump's going to play. Trump's going to get played like a violin by Putin, because I think Putin is just so much savvier, so much more disciplined, so much more studious than Trump is. And so that will put the United States at a disadvantage. I do want to say, though, that I think the one thing I agree with Trump on is that it'd be a good thing if the United States had better relations with Russia. And I think all the noise coming out of the Democratic Party on this Russia meddling in the U.S. elections needs to be sobered a little bit, because the United States has been meddling in people's elections all over the world, including Russia's with Yeltsin back in the 90s. And sometimes when we don't like the results of the elections, we overthrow the government. And so for people just to be shocked that Russia was meddling in our elections, I mean, it's not a good thing. I'm not in favor of it, but let's be real here. And more importantly, you know, we're all worried about North Korea maybe getting one intercontinental ballistic missile. Russia's got 3,000 of them. And the idea that we should have hostile relations with Russia, or that Hillary Clinton was saying we should shoot down Russian planes over Syria, that's insanity. We need to cool the temperature down between Moscow and Washington. And if Trump succeeds at that, I actually think that would be a good thing.
Do you think that would be a good thing, Kevin?
I agree with Matt in the sense that there should be at least respectable relations between Moscow and Washington. I think the problem with Trump is that he's extremely naive to the situation he's got walking into with Putin. Putin is former KGB. He's all these other things. And I understand why during the campaign Trump said we need to work with Russia, because he was looking for an ally to battle ISIS. The problem is Russia, when it looks at ISIS, sees it basically as kind of a mosquito they can use to push and bug the U.S. with while they're off doing other things, such as planning the eventual takeover of the Balkans or recapturing Ukraine or something like that. So, but, you know, we'll see what happens. I think, you know, he's walking into a situation where is willfully unprepared, and I think the reality of that first meeting is what worries me, and Matt actually hit it on, where you have this high intensity portion of the Democratic base. And I went to some of the early town halls. I'm in Glenn Grothman's district, so I watched one in Sheboygan a couple months ago, and where it is Russia, Russia, Russia for a lot of liberal advocate activists who just can't get past 2016. And I don't doubt there was tinkering going on in the election, because that's what Russia does, especially the KGB and their hackers. I've often wondered if they were going into this, and this is just my own personal theory. I think like everybody else on this planet, they thought Hillary was going to win, and they hacked her to build blackmail against her potential administration, not to help a potential Trump administration. So therein lies my theory on that. But where was I going?
Let me jump in because it's related. So these two leaders are meeting amid that ongoing FBI mm-hmm. investigation into not only Russia's meddling in the election, which, you know, may be something the U.S. has done too, but the possible Trump campaign collusion
this investigation has been going on in some way, shape, or form from the Obama administration to through the Trump administration and the Justice Department and all the other intelligence agencies for now, what, almost a year, maybe more? So going back with where Matt was talking about the Democratic base, I'm half anticipating, because of just the way she's gone conspiratorial on things, Rachel Maddow to go into this kind of, you know, screenshot by screenshot, frame by frame. Oh, look at this double blink by Trump. That's him saying, thank you for giving me the election. That's the kind of thing I'm expecting to see from liberal, you know, talking points about this way this thing is going, because of just the insanity when it comes to Russia and the election. That being said, this is another theory I have. I think, you know, and this has been proven by other people who said this in the intelligence community, the Obama administration knew about meddling that Russia was doing. Why didn't they speak out earlier? Why did they keep quiet? Were they afraid of the fact that by them looking incompetent, it would make Hillary look incompetent and then make Trump a better alternative? That's never been fully explained.
Well, let me just try to explain. First of all, I think Obama thought, you know, if he does something public about it, it's going to be like he's tipping the scales toward Hillary. So I think he thought he was in a no-win situation. And just on the flip side, I mean, let's have a little thought experiment and say the Democratic candidate was alleged to be colluding with Russia. And the Democratic candidate said in public during the campaign, hey, Russia, please get those 30,000 emails on my opponent and release them. Trump said that. And that Democratic candidate would have been tarred and feathered and sent on a rail. And right now, Trump's president of the United States. Yeah. I mean, the Democratic candidate would have had to get out of the race.
Well, that would also ensue. So you would then have a Democratic base that would finally admit that Hillary's emails mattered. And they, you know, for months and months and months, that was never happening. But let's not redredge 2016. That's months ago.
Well, I never carried water for Hillary Clinton, and I have a lot of problems with her. But I do think if the shoe was on the other foot, we would have had a dramatically different situation here.
Well, do you expect, Matt, that this is going to come up, the whole Russian meddling / investigation during this meeting? Or
well, to the extent that it comes up at all, it would be Trump saying, you're a naughty boy, don't do it again, now let's get down to business so I can go back and tell everyone in Washington that I mentioned this scandal. I don't think it's going to be anything more than that.
Yeah, I agree with Matt on that sense. And plus, you also have, you know, he's kind of in a no-win situation when it comes to the election stuff, because ever since election night, he's been, this is the psyche of the president I'm looking at here, but he's been dealing with a media and a political opposition that says, you only won because of Russian meddling. So if he even says anything about it, you know, he then, you know, has to deal with his ego going, well, you know, did I only win because of Russian meddling? And then you have Democrats on the Hill, Pelosi, Adam Schiff, et cetera, Chuck Schumer, saying he needs to be tough on Russia. Where were these guys for the last 5 years when Mitt Romney was saying about this versus Barack Obama telling us all during a debate, sorry, the 80s called and they want their foreign policy back? I mean,
I wasn't going to bring this up at this point, but I think I will, just because of the media reference. And both you guys are media guys, in that the big news earlier this week was the tweet that President Trump tweeted out, that was him wrestling some guy with a CNN logo on his head. Some said this was, you know, encouraging violence against the media. It was just yet another salvo in the fake news wars that are going on. He was asked about this in Poland too, and again defended his sending out of that tweet and defended his criticism of CNN and the mainstream media in general as talking all about fake news. He says this Russia stuff is all fake news. Kevin, it's all fake news?
Well, in terms of the tweet itself, I thought it was extremely childish coming from a president of the United States. I remember sending a tweet out myself when all this was going on, because I was like going, you know, I wanted to kind of enjoy my 4th of July weekend, and then Saturday got ruined by this GIF/GIF warfare.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm going, you know, Mr. President, grow up. The media, grow a pair. And could the rest of us ignore it? Because maybe it'll go away. Because Trump is, you know, if they said he's the classic counterpuncher. If he's going to attack, he'll, if he feels like he's been attacked, he will attack back. harder. The problem is, this is a president, and even in the campaign, who used, you know, the media's opposition to him to his advantage. You have a conservative base, which, you know, rightfully or wrongfully, does believe the media is against them. You know, I can't think of countless times after I've written a column, I've got somebody, you know, calling me a troglodyte. I'm going, what the heck? I just said, you know, this is an economic policy that should be in going to. How does this make me evil? But, you know, versus the scenario where, you know, CNN, especially these last 2 weeks, when you add in a couple, they have kind of shot themselves in the foot with a Russian story. You had three journalists resign over one. And the fact that over these last 6 months, you've had a bunch of Russian stories, which the headlines sound scary, but when you go into the details, there's nothing there. So the problem with me in this Russia collusion story is there's a ton of smoke, no fire, no evidence.
Matt?
Well, you know, Kevin mentions Trump's childishness, which is undeniable. He mentions Trump's ego and Trump battling with his ego, which, you know, should be televised constantly. And I guess it is being televised constantly. And it's,
we're in the reality
TV show. It's not a pretty sight. I mean, this guy is clinically has narcissistic personality disorder. I mean, he's a five-year-old turning the White House into a playpen. Unfortunately, the playpen's got nuclear weapons in it, so that's a dangerous thing. But yeah, his ego, I mean, he's got absolutely the wrong personality for the job. That's one thing. The other thing is, with vis-a-vis the CNN issue that you raised, Joy, is that he has no respect for democracy. And that is equally troubling. I mean, to call the Fourth Estate, the media, the enemy of the people is an outrageous thing for a president of the United States to do. To go after the judiciary, you know, so-called judges, and undermining the judiciary is an outrageous thing for a president to do. Those are the things, both his personality disorder and his lack of respect for our democratic institutions are what deeply trouble me.
We have a caller, Nate, in Milwaukee on this topic. Hi, Nate.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I was going to point out that the war between Trump and CNN raises a few interesting questions about Trump, because the video I tweeted about recently was put together by somebody with bigotry issues. And if you look at the Veritas video that he promoted, there's questions relating to that, because the Veritas guy has done things deceptively, like when he edited a video with an NPR official, and also he's done it for money, because I, for example, reportedly when he was paid thousands of dollars around the time he did the Mike Ellis video.
So what's your point, Nate?
Oh, that he put that he may be generating his own fake news.
So President Trump is generating his own fake news. Matt?
Well, I do think the president, first of all, it's just ridiculous, and let's just say it out loud, that we have a president who's tweeting all the time. I mean, it's like he's a teenager. And it's so unpresidential. It's so undiplomatic. It's something we've never seen before, and I hope we'll never see again. Also, on the retweets, if I were a staff, I would just be pulling my hair out, because they should take his Twitter account down, for one thing. Secondly, he's retweeting some stuff that is vile. He doesn't know where it's coming from. Maybe he does, but the people who originate the tweet are very unsavory. Nate was alluding to this person who is alleged to have issued anti-Semitic remarks. I mean, it's crazy time.
Kevin?
Well, in terms of Trump generating his own fake news, he wouldn't be the first politician in this universe to try to drum up a smokescreen for something else that's going on that he doesn't want to talk about. As for the Twitter account, I mean, it's amazing to me to watch liberals kind of confront the Trump Twitter apparatus when conservatives like myself and others who were never Trumpers were screaming about this for a year. And we're voices in the wilderness going, this needs to stop. This is insanity. What is he doing? Where is he finding this stuff? Be it Reddit. I don't know if he's finding this stuff his own. I mean, apparently his new media guru from the campaign, who apparently once upon a time used to be his golf caddy, so he really does reward loyalty. you know, finds these things, and, you know, Lord knows what the heck he's finding, because apparently the story is only two people have access to the Twitter account, the president and this guy. So the question is, who's getting these tweets, this Trump or this guy? So, I mean, it's something you would love for him to stop. What is it, like 71% of Americans in the last poll were like, please, Mr. President, stop tweeting. This is getting embarrassing.
Yeah, you know, but do have supporters, though, of President Trump who are posting on our Facebook page that they love this, that they think that this is great, that that President Trump is bypassing the filter of the media and going directly to the people.
I understand going straight to the people. I mean, you know, FDR did it with his fireside chats. Every president or politician who has a new form of media or communications is smart to find a way to use their own sounding board. The question is he doing it in a correct manner? Criticize the way he said it or not. I actually thought, you know, Governor Scott Walker was correct in the sense that if he's going to tweet more, he should stay focused on what he's tweeting. Is it going to be, you know, the policy I'm pushing this week in the White House? Is it going to be a bill that I'm going to see passed on the Hill? Instead of, you know, going after, you know, the cast of Morning Joe or CNN or something else like that, which is completely non-productive.
Well, I agree with, you know, going after Morning Joe and Mika Brzezinski is foolish. But also commenting on affairs of state in a kind of off-the-cuff way, seat-of-the-pants way, like North Korea, intercontinental missile and a ballistic missile. And he just,
and the ellipsing around the world.
Yeah, and he just sends out a tweet. I mean, that is just, from a diplomatic standpoint, is so contrary to everything that you want to see happen in a careful, disciplined, rational White House that, you know, Rex Tillerson must just be spilling blood over there.
Yeah, we'll talk about North Korea after this break and other top stories in the news during this edition of our Week in Review. We have with us two guests who come from different political perspectives, Matt Rothschild, Executive Director of Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and Kevin Benversi, Research Director with Media Trackers. You can join in with your thoughts on the issues in the news this week at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Week in Review here on the Ideas Network. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with two guests about the top stories in state, national, and international politics this week. Kevin Benversi is with us and Matt Rothschild. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So the other big topic of conversation at the G20 summit, besides the face-to-face meeting that's happening this hour between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin, is North Korea. Earlier this week, U.S. officials confirmed that North Korea launched a first-of-its-kind intercontinental ballistic missile, one that presumably has the range to potentially reach Alaska. In a news conference on Thursday, President Trump had this to say about possible actions against North Korea.
I think we'll just take a look at what happens over the coming weeks and months with respect to North Korea. It's a shame that they're behaving this way, but they are behaving in a very, very dangerous manner, and something will have to be done about it.
Yeah, he said maybe severe consequences, but he wasn't going to say exactly what those severe consequences might be. Kevin, what do you make of President Trump's response to what North Korea did?
Well, given the fact that you have, a potential nuclear missile heading either to Anchorage, San Francisco, or other places on the West Coast, you know, Honolulu, It's a tough situation. I mean, this is reportedly, you know, the limo ride over from the White House to the Capitol Hill. You know, reportedly Obama said, you know, your first major issue, Mr. Trump, on a foreign affairs side will be North Korea. So, and the problem is you're looking at North Korea and you need help from the Chinese, because the way North Korea has their economy, if you wish to call it such a thing, established, it's all through China. So you need China to play a hard hand with him. Fortunately, the Chinese view North Korea the same way, as I said, Russia views ISIS, this nice little gnat to annoy us. So Lord knows if you're going to get assistance from them. The problem is the only way this ends is, you know, there's three scenarios, two of which are really bad, especially for the South Koreans. You have the North Koreans launch a missile. We, you know, understandably, you know, counterstrike. We strike them first, which then the North Koreans counterstrike and obliterate, turn Seoul into a parking lot, and probably Busan as well. And the third one is some sort of diplomatic solution, which clearly has proven to be counterproductive over the last 20 years, because all the North Koreans do when they act up is they want something, and then they usually take that something that they get, you know, be it, you know, relieve sanctions or money, and then turn it into a weapons program.
Matt?
Well, this is the problem of straight out of hell, because there's no decent, feasible solution. I don't think that China views North Korea as a gnat to bother the United States with necessarily, because they're worried about North Korea dissolving and then, you know, millions of people coming into China, which is not exactly what they want or need. And it's not just a South Korea problem either, because it's an American problem. There are not only because of the missile reaching the United States, but there are 30,000 U.S. soldiers within real easy range of North Korea's traditional military weapons, non-nuclear. So if there is a nuclear war, God forbid, and I mean, the idea that we're talking about it in public is disgusting, too, just that we've come to that. You know, there would be just total destruction on the Korean Peninsula, and, you know, millions of people would die, including those 30,000 U.S. troops right away. And so this is not an outcome that anyone rational should want to see, and I'm hoping Trump dials down the irrationality, because we don't want to provoke North Korea into doing something suicidal, but also very destructive of millions of people on the peninsula. So there, you know, we got to stress the diplomatic route, and it's not an easy route either. But certainly the military route is an impossible one.
One avenue of this, and this clearly seems to be the route that Trump is trying to needle his way through, is pressure on China. As Matt said, if there's disaster on the Korean Peninsula, you're going to see hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of North Koreans. They're only going to go one way. They're going to go north and going to head into China, and China does not want that refugee problem on their hands. So that is essentially the greatest leverage we have on them, which is, you know, you need to get, you know, call it your pit bull, call it your gnat, under control, because these guys, they thought it was, I mean, it was clearly it was cute to Beijing for a number of decades. Now it's just completely out of control.
This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Kevin Benversi and Matt Rothschild about the top stories in the news this week. We welcome your input. Is there an issue from the news that you want us to discuss at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We had full lines, people wanting to talk about fake news and presidential tweets, but now we have open lines. I did want to bring up another topic that's related to Russia and fake news. MSNBC anchor Rachel Maddow yesterday revealed what she claims to be a forged National Security Agency document that was sent to her and warned that it could be part of a larger ploy to dupe and discredit journalists for reporting on Russian meddling in the 2016 election story. So is this maybe fake news is being sent to journalists from I don't know who to discredit journalists? Matt, what do you think of this?
I don't know what to make of it. I didn't see the report last night, so I probably shouldn't comment further.
Yeah, any comment from you,
Kevin? This is the first I've heard of it, but from the segments I've seen online of Maddow when it comes to Russia, be it on her own show or appearances she's had on Stephen Colbert's show, she's playing with fireworks, and especially with the way her conspiratorial tone is on this issue, so she better be careful.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Mike in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I'm just wondering, for your guest speaker, what the possibility would be as far as sending a message to North Korea that the next time they attempt to launch an ICBM, that we just shoot it down and kill it before it runs its experiment. What are the possibilities of that?
Why doesn't the U.S. do that? Do we know, Kevin?
We're still, 30 years, missile defense, and we have good terrestrial missile detection stuff. It's the ICBM stuff that's still hit and miss. I mean, I believe of the five tests we've done, two have been successful, three have been near successes. So it's still in the wonder into that developmental stage. The problem is if they throw everything they have at us, most of the defense people I've read on this topic have said we should be quote unquote be able to get most of it. The problem is, well, it's most of it. What happens to those that then land? Say what you want, I've been a big fan of SDI, Strategic Defensive Initiative, since I was a kid. I was an 80s Cold Warrior as a grade schooler. So, I mean, thank you, Ronald Reagan, for having the foresight to think of this stuff.
Yeah. Any comment, Matt?
Yeah, well, there are two problems with the suggestion Mike makes. One, Kevin alludes to, that technically we may not be able to do it. But the other one is it'll be seen by North Korea as an act of war, and then, all bets are off, and we'll have just a catastrophe in the nuclear peninsula and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people dead. That's why it's not a solution. As far as the Strategic Defense Initiative, what we need to have is not a better shield. We need to get rid of nuclear weapons. That's the crisis, really, that we're facing here, and we've been playing nuclear chicken now for 60 years. And at some point, it's not going to end well unless we, with the other nuclear powers, get rid of our nuclear weapons and make it impossible for other countries to get them.
I know this is going to be counterintuitive to what Matt just said, but one theory that's often been thrown out there is, it's been 70 years since World War II. Is it time to let Japan arm up finally? Because they have been looking at this. They're getting parentheses from these missiles. One part of the missile will end up in the Sea of Japan, and another part will end up on the other side of Japan. So they're worried, and that's understandably so in their own national defense. So the question is, do you let the Japanese arm up to actually have a legitimate army then? That's, do you let Japan go nuclear? What does China say? Those are all theoretical things that have been played out in the Defense Department. Some have worked out, some haven't. So, we're in a no-win hell situation here with, dictators who think they're frankly walking versions of God.
So,
or they're trying to, I'm sorry, Joe, mm-hmm. They may be, he may be more rational than we think in North Korea, because maybe he thinks this is the only thing that's going to keep his country from being destroyed like Iraq was destroyed or Libya was destroyed.
Any other comments on the G20 summit and what's going to happen there? Apparently,
I look forward to whatever the family photo costume will be, because the G20 is always notorious for having these really stupid costume pictures.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. So, and they're usually themed to the country. Like in Korea a couple years ago, they were all in kind of these smock things, and every world leader is going to be in one.
They're going to have lederhosen.
So that's
what
I was wondering. Are we going to see Trump in lederhosen? And what is, like, is Merkel going to be in like a milkmaid outfit or something? So
I rather doubt that. But Matt, have any? I mean, we have climate change is likely to come up because of Trump withdrawing from the Paris Accord. There's Syria fighting terrorism. NATO. Anything else that you're watching when it comes to G20?
I'm just watching how much Donald Trump alienates the other European leaders, and how high the eyebrows of those leaders are bouncing when he says something inappropriate.
Well, let's move on to some other issues, as we have many others, and our hour is waning. Let's talk about the Republican lawmakers, congresspeople who came back for the 4th of July recess. Some were marching in 4th of July parades. They were met by angry voters, angry over the GOP health care bill. These Republican lawmakers have been confronting angry constituents at town hall meetings ever since the repeal and replace debate began. And I see that protesters staged a sit-in at Senator Ron Johnson's office in Oshkosh. Looks like this was yesterday. It's unclear whether what's going to happen to this plan that's in the U.S. Senate. A vote was postponed on it last week. Is this plan moving forward, Matt? What do you think?
I sure hope not, and it doesn't look like it is. I think the fact that Mitch McConnell couldn't get it done before the July 4th weekend was a signal that he's not as much of a magician as people were suggesting he was. And once the weekend came and the legislators got hit with their constituents' reactions, it seems to me that the odds of the bill passing now have diminished.
Kevin?
On the realities of the bill, I kind of concur. I concur with Matt. I will say a lot of these protests are well organized. They were all going to organize, if there was going to be a vote last week or not, a lot of these sit-ins. But that being said, my frustration as a conservative watching this is clearly there was no plan for repeal and replace for the 6 years that we were campaigning on this. If I was doing this, and part of this is, I mean, you have a president who clearly doesn't understand the policy side of this issue, just wants it over, just wants the win. He's been listening to Rand Paul, who clearly is in these last 6 months on this issue, showcased he can't strategize his way out of a paper bag. And I mean, it was amazing because the first idea was, okay, repeal, set a clock on it, replace it with something where everyone sits down and determines what's the principle. Because everyone, I mean, even liberals now are admitting that Obamacare is collapsing. You have, last week alone, you had Blue Cross Blue Shield drop out of Wisconsin and its exchange, or the National Exchange Promise Wisconsin. So, I mean, now, I mean, you have competing proposals. I actually like the Ted Cruz idea, which is, you can still offer Obamacare exchange plans, but then you can offer quote unquote non-compliant plans, which are on the cheaper, more free market side. The problem now you're dealing with is, and this is clearly what happened with the McConnell plan, he completely ignored the Group of 13 working group ideas and just produced a proposal that was to get them through the 2018 elections, not actually produce a good solid piece of legislation.
I mean, as Kevin says, I mean, it's just amazing that after making political hay on this issue when they didn't have power, that they didn't bother to have a plan that they could pull off the shelf that would adequately make sure that people in this country could get decent health care or at least decent health care insurance. And then we have the president who all of a sudden wakes up and understands that, wow, health care is a complicated issue. I mean, it is just kind of mind-boggling.
Well, the president also said, well, let's repeal Obamacare and replace it at a later date. What about that idea?
Well, I mean, that's even more brutal. I mean, what's going to happen with people with pre-existing conditions? What's going to happen for the 500,000 people in Wisconsin who are children, who are on Medicaid? The idea to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, which is how I prefer to call it, and replace it with nothing would return us to the status quo ante where people who had pre-existing conditions or who had loved ones with pre-existing conditions were facing just a horrible human tragedy.
Here's an idea from a state representative, Eric Genrich, a Democrat from Green Bay, is proposing Badger Care for All. It's a bill that would allow Wisconsin residents to enroll in the state's Badger Care program, essentially opening it up to all income levels. What do you think of that idea, Kevin?
I first and foremost was rather intrigued at the fact he didn't bring a price tag to that. That's always rather fascinating. That's why one of the biggest hurdles that the left is going to have in their push for single payer or Medicaid for all, Medicare for all, as Bernie Sanders keeps pushing it, is there's already a policy paper out there that says the cost of a Medicare for all single payer system would account to $32 trillion. That's with a T. Trillion for over 10 years. So that's the cost you have of doing this, of creating this single payer, whatever. California, which is by far the most progressive state we have in this country when it comes to politics, couldn't even do it this year because they saw the price tag and gulped at it. So that's my take on it, is if he didn't come with a price tag, it's not a real plan.
Matt?
Well, I like the idea of a public option. I thought President Obama should have included that in the Affordable Care Act. I think it's a good idea. I think we will get to Medicare for All at some point in this country and come to understand, as Bernie Sanders has been saying all along, that health care is a human right. and that it shouldn't depend on your income, whether you're going to get decent health care or not. And I just think with the assaults on the Affordable Care Act and the lack of an alternative on the Republican side, that people are going to understand we need a better solution. And the best solution is this Medicare for All solution.
When we come back, we will talk about state budget issues. We'll talk about a new candidate, a potential candidate for governor, State Superintendent Tony Evers, says he's considering. And we will also talk about Governor Walker's response to the Trump administration's request for voter data from Wisconsin. And maybe you have something you'd like to bring up. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is The Week in Review on the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking today with Kevin Benversi, Research Director at Media Trackers, and Matt Rothschild, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. We're reviewing the top stories in the news this week, and let's turn to some state issues. Let's turn to one that's got state and national implications. Governor Walker is kind of sidestepping this issue, this Trump administration request for voter data. He says he's not going to get in the middle of it. It's between the Trump administration and Wisconsin's election commission. First off, Matt, what do you make of the Trump administration wanting this voter data from states?
I think it's an outrageous claim by the federal government. It's against Wisconsin law for the elections commission to, you know, give all that information to anybody. And so I'm glad the Wisconsin Elections Commission didn't cave on it. And, you know, Walker should have stood up for the Wisconsin Elections Commission and Wisconsin law on this one.
Election officials in Wisconsin say they will give up certain information. I don't think they're going to give up Social Security numbers. They say, though, the feds have to pay for it. State election laws do prohibit the Wisconsin Elections Commission from releasing a voter's date of birth, driver's license number, or Social Security number. And again, Governor Walker is staying out of it, saying you don't want a politician, you don't want a Republican or a Democrat directly involved with the election commission. Is that right, Kevin?
Well, my take on this story is it's kind of twofold. Is one, there's been no real clear explanation from the Trump Elections Commission why they want this data in the first place. So that's been the big giant mystery, and I think that's there's an understandable pushback of why are you wanting this. Secondly, as you mentioned, I mean, this data is readily available and can be bought and sold on a whim for those who want to pay for it. There's just certain things that are filtered out. And are purchased countless times by both political parties in this state, by campaigns nationally and statewide as well. And this is any state. You can go in and say, hi, like your state voter base, you know, and they say, okay, well, this is how much it's going to cost you, but we can't give you this, 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 and this. So, I mean, it's one of these things where it feels partially there's too many questions that need to be answered, and also there's pushback, understandable pushback, but questionable pushback.
And also, it's an issue. You know, there's no issue here. There's no voter fraud that's significant in any mathematical way. And so you have Trump on this fishing expedition, and the head of the fishing boat is this guy from Kansas, Chris Kobach, Secretary of State there, who's been one of the leaders in the effort to suppress turnout around the country. And so here we have the President of the United States trying to make it harder for people to vote.
Moving on to Wisconsin State Superintendent Tony Evers, saying he is considering running for governor as a Democrat next year. Evers told the Wisconsin State Journal in a story published today that he has been encouraged to run by a number of people after his lopsided reelection to a third term in April. So would Tony Evers be a good challenger for Governor Walker, Matt?
Well, I don't weigh in as to who's the best challenger. I don't endorse candidates, but I do think everybody should get in the pool. They should get in the pool pretty fast because I think Democratic voters have should have a choice in a primary, and that the field shouldn't be cleared by the poobahs in the Democratic Party either in Wisconsin or nationally. So fight it out.
Yeah, last week, and we did have State Senator Kathleen Vinehout on our State Capitol Report. She registered as a potential candidate for governor, and Madison Mayor Paul Soglin was saying, hey, I'm going to run for not only re-election as Madison mayor, but I might run for governor as well. He's saying, hey, Bernie Sanders was surprisingly successful in Wisconsin as an older white guy who's a liberal, so maybe Paul Soglin would have luck doing that. So what do you make first, Kevin, of Tony Evers considering a run for governor?
Well, first I say congratulations, Tony, for finally removing the mask. You know, we've all known you'd be a partisan Democrat for your years as DPI superintendent, so thank you for finally showcasing that to the rest of the state. Secondly, if I was a young Democrat in my 20s and 30s, I would seriously start wondering to myself, why is all the guys who are considering to run for governor 50, 60-year-old white dudes, with the exception of Kathleen Vinon. Mm-hmm. But it's like, where is the youth in the party? Where is that guy who's going to be the leader to go forth into the echelons of the 21st century? Because you have Paul Soglin in his 70s, you have Tony Evers in his 60s, you have a couple businessmen in Milwaukee who are both in their late 50s, early 60s. So where is, you know, versus Scott Walker, who's in his mid-40s and would definitely look much, much younger. So, I mean, you know, yeah. It's going to be, if it's a big, giant Democratic Party primary, I say go ahead, beat each other up.
I mean, I do think... I mean, people always talk about the weak Democratic bench. I don't see it as that weak. And I'm in the Capitol sometimes, and there are some very impressive legislators who are a generation younger than what Kevin's talking about. There's Jocasta Zamarripa and Chris Taylor and Melissa Sargent and Diane Hasselbein and Katrina Shanklin. That's probably the future of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. And there just needs to be a transition between the old guard and this new guard that's coming up.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org if you have a question or comment about some of these state political issues that we are talking about. Let's talk some budget issues. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss joined us earlier this week on our State Capitol Report. He called on the state Senate to come up with a transportation plan that can pass both chambers. He was a little bit upset that an idea to raise fees on heavy trucks was shot down immediately, as well as some other assembly plans to try to raise revenue and help pay for that transportation fund deficit. Here's what Speaker Voss had to say on the State Capitol Report.
The only thing that I've said to the Senate is we are not going to continue to borrow and spend. So come back to us with a plan that either raises revenues to be able to help us pay for the roads that we all know need to be redone, or we're going to be at base, which means we don't borrow any more money, and projects not just are going to be delayed, but they're going to have to be canceled. And I think nobody in the state wants that. But if you're not willing to raise the revenues, it's not conservative to borrow and spend, which is unfortunately what it seems like our Senate colleagues are talking about.
So is Speaker Voss right, Kevin?
Well, I agree with him on the sense of borrowing. I'm not a fan of borrowing to pay for roads and bonding. Has been up. You know, it's been up since the Jim Doyle years. The problem I'm having on the way he's doing this is, you know, I've had a number of conversations with Speaker Voss, you know, both on and off the record since, you know, the end of last year when the budget was starting to formulate. And he's always used this analogy about, well, you know, I was dealt a hand with like a pair of twos and something else, some sort of bizarre poker analogy. And you keep going to yourself, okay, that's fine, understandable. You have, you know, the governor who's not going to raise, who's flat out said, I'm not going to raise taxes and fees. You have the Senate, which says, you know, we're being realistic here. We're not going to, you know, we can only go what Governor Walker is going to sign. And then you still have Robin Voss and his cabal of John Nygren and Jim Steinke, both guys who I like, who are kind of like trying to storm the castle with a battering ram made of tinfoil. And they keep whamming against the wall with a tax of the week proposal, which is starting to bring you on yourself, okay, so when do we start declaring you guys Republican road builders? Because this is getting to the point where it's like, are you actually going to get the budget done, or are you just holding out for one lobby, which has said, you know, we need more money? Because if you look at the transportation budget, and that audit showed us earlier this year that DOT cannot be trusted, and basically what the state assembly is trying to do is just a status quo budget for DOT, but we give them more money.
Matt?
Well, I think everyone listening understands that the roads in Wisconsin are terrible. I mean, in one score, we're 47th in the country, and the other, we're 49th. And the Republicans have been in power, and it's one of the basic roles of government to make sure that the roads are okay. So they've been derelict in their duties there. I, as a spectator, I'm kind of enjoying the squabbling among the Republican leaders, and I do think it's getting to look quite childish. The Speaker, I believe, was right on proposing that trucking fee. The big trucks are the ones that degrade the roads more than anything. Of course, it was going to go nowhere because the groups that have power in this state are Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and the other big business lobbies, and the trucking industry themselves gave Walker $700,000 since 2010, and Republican lawmakers about $270,000. That's how politics works in Wisconsin. So that was a good proposal that got shot down. Increasing the gas tax is a good proposal. The reason we're in this problem right now is because the Republicans put a freeze on the gas tax, and you know, it's on them.
Kevin?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think it's I guess it's just a horrible idea that we actually have our state legislators vote on a tax increase and go on the record. That was the whole reason for eliminating indexing. Secondly, this is now the second straight week in review where the liberal commentator has said Robin Voss is right. So if you're Robin Voss's office and you're listening to this comment right now, think about that. You had earlier this week Jeff Wagner unload on you on talk radio, meaning you are losing the PR war in what should be your home base of conservative talk radio in this state. Ask yourself, is it worth to keep using that tinfoil battering ram against the gates of Scott Walker and his Scott Walker's opposition, and Scott Fitzgerald saying, I have five members of my caucus who have said they're not going to sign on to this. Why do you keep doing it? So therein lies the question for Robin Voss's office.
Well, on Wednesday, Governor Walker did offer what could break the impasse on transportation funding. Walker is proposing lowering borrowing for road projects by $200 million, down from the $500 million proposed in his budget, and relying on contingency borrowing that is linked to federal funding. The proposal still would not increase the gas tax or vehicle fees. So is this going to bring everybody together, Kevin?
Probably not, because it was shot down fairly quickly by the Assembly GOP and Robin Voss and Steinecke and Nygren. So, but I think it's a sign that Walker's willing to compromise, that, you know, that, you know, that this is, if okay, you guys say bonding's too much, okay, fine, we'll cut down on the bonding. So, but clearly what you have is you have Assembly GOP folks who are just committed to seeing revenue increase versus a governor who's saying, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to force that hand on Wisconsin consumers.
Yeah, we have just a minute to go. Wisconsin was supposed to have a new budget at the beginning of the fiscal year, which started on Saturday, but it doesn't. No big deal, Matt?
Well, we can continue to hobble along here for a while, but it's embarrassing. At the very least, and at some point, it's going to start taking a bite. And I don't think Walker's proposal is going to solve the issue. He had some fudgy words there, like other administrative actions are going to solve the transportation budget problem. And, yeah, I just think until they can get their acts together and stop squabbling, you know, we're going to go on through this hot summer.
30 seconds. Will we have a budget by the fall, Kevin?
Yeah, I think we'll have one by the fall. The question is, again, you know, how long is the Assembly GOP willing to take this PR hit against them? Because, I mean, you clearly have a governor's office that's not going to budge on what the hardline Assembly GOP stance is, which is more revenue, more taxes, more whatever.
Well, we'll leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you both very much for being here.
My pleasure.
Kevin Benversi is the research director with Media Trackers, and Matt Rothschild is executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Thanks to producers Chris Molina, Brianne Chasso, and August Brown. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Week in Review on the Ideas Network.